Here's the last case this morning. 17-3105 McDermott v. Ford Motor Company.
Thank you, Your Honors. It's a privilege to be in this court and today on the occasion of having a swear-in of three law clerks to keep us on course. Your Honors, the district judge, Judge McGuire's decision should be reversed and remanded on the basis that the defendants filed a motion for summary judgment and two Daubert motions on the same day. The facts, we believe, are clear in the record that they are independent upon each other. Well,
you were late responding, isn't that true? And you didn't seek an extension prior to the expiration of your time?
If the motions are dispositive.
It's not dispositive. Under the rule, the Kansas rule specifically says what are dispositive motions.
No, it doesn't.
And, yes, it does.
It classifies, Your Honor.
Pardon?
It classifies what are, but it does not define what is a dispositive motion. And that's where we have our problem in this case.
It says responses, well, let me just get it right here. Well, go ahead while I try to find
it. Well, I think Your Honor's talking about the 14-day rule and the 21-day rule.
Well, that's what you were arguing. You're arguing that you had 21 days.
Well, I am arguing that, Judge, because of the fact that the motion on all the facts, and as a matter of law, is a dispositive motion. These Daubert motions are dispositive.
Well, was the motion a dispositive motion, or was merely a dispositive ruling on a 14-day motion?
Well, it can't.
You had to persuade at least one of the members of the panel.
Yeah, I understand that, Your Honor. You can't take jurisdiction away from a litigant.
Well, Rule 6.1, Sub 2.
Yes.
Says responses to motions to dismiss, motions for summary judgment, motions to remand, motions for judgment on the pleadings. They're defined as dispositive, and a Daubert motion is not one of them.
Well,
now, the effect of not having an expert may result in inability to continue the case.
That's one way of looking at it.
I'm looking at the rule.
Well, the rule, Your Honor.
It also says that a different rule says that if you need more time, you have to seek it before the time expires.
Factually, in this case, if I can give you the background, when we received the motion for summary judgment, the two Daubert motions on the same day, I contacted my experts. One of my experts' wife was suffering from terminal cancer and could not respond within a period of time.
The other, go to the court and tell them that?
I did. It's in the record, our motions for extension of time. Yes, it's in the record. And then the other expert, and they have been throughout the proceedings, described testimony of our medical expert, had been shot accidentally in a hunting accident where he was tangled up with his dog and got shot in the leg and was in the hospital.
Who shot him?
Pardon me? Well, I think it was it was holstered, but it could have been a rifle. However, I contact the defense and I say, look, I'm going to need a little extension of time on my motion for summary judgment to respond because I have two experts that I need to have provide affidavits to contend with the motion for summary judgment. So if the court looks at the facts and determines that this is interdependent, the motions are interdependent upon each other. When we And so I went ahead and I filed my extension. I said, look, I want to file my extension. No problem on the motion for summary judgment, but yeah, we have a problem on the Daubert motions. So I was timely on the motion for summary judgment. I was able to obtain the reports from my experts to respond to the motion for summary judgment. And I did, and it was timely filed on March 14th of 2016. So, to paraphrase Shakespeare, a dispositive motion by any other name is a dispositive motion. Now, the rule been discussed in some of these motions to strike. Now, the motions to strike, if you look at the record, basically it was trying to tie the plaintiff's expert's hands by refusing to allow him to provide a report based upon scientific information. So they were trying to take away a report about the reasonable rate sensitive abdominal dummies. It was a report from a Ford member, and that was included in the timely report of the expert. But the defendants were upset because it was my disclosure. I was late, 2 or 3 days late. Now, from my from here on out, any disclosure, that door opens up and there is a big mad bull that's just ready to charge and take me out. The disclosure rules and the motion to strike, as we've stated in the briefs, are extremely timely, time consuming, very difficult. And we responded to those. And the magistrate, Judge Teresa James, said, look, there's no prejudice here. They were untimely, but you have to show prejudice. But what they were doing were trying to take out medical records that the medical expert had to rely upon, taking out records that were required our engineering expert. One other thing they attempted to do, when their expert provided a study on the last day of their submission under the scheduling order, it was in September 25th of 2015, there was a study that our engineer had to rely upon and provide this in the affidavit to respond to the motion for summary judgment. That also was part and parcel of a motion to strike, the second motion to strike, where Judge...
Well, they denied that motion to strike, didn't they?
Pardon me?
They denied the motion to strike.
Well, they not completely. There were two items. And I have a problem with this disclosure and treating physicians when I give them the medical records, and it's a death case. Well, what do I have to disclose? I've given you everything. You've got a right to talk to the doctors. You can go and independently depose. But Judge James, struggling through this whole thing, determined that there were two treating physicians that the defendants had a right to depose, and they did. One, they deposed one within the May 11th, 2016 deadline. And we were to otherwise recreate a demonstration to show our theory of product failure. Now, throughout this effort here, we had a pattern of injury, very significant. Those were part of the Daubert motion to strike. So there are even the motions to strike, if you look at the record objectively, we believe, I probably shouldn't say that, but if you look at it objectively, number one, the defense tried to tie the hands of our experts by not giving information that obviously they had a right to use in their reports. And secondly, when they did the Daubert motions, to rely upon those as a part and parcel of the summary judgment motion. The Sixth Circuit and the Second Circuit have taken objection to this, and they're calling these summary judgments. Now, if the rule says summary judgment, black letter summary judgment, and you cannot look at it as to whether or not it actually is a dispositive motion, then we're stuck. And I don't believe we should be stuck.
Well, what do you want us to do? You're asking us to announce, to issue an opinion saying that a Daubert motion is a dispositive motion?
No. I want the court to recognize the fact that if a motion is dispositive, that litigants are entitled to have summary judgment protections.
If the result of a motion is dispositive.
Right. And now, Judge Goodwin, and we've provided that in the brief.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
Can I just ask a procedural question? I'm a little confused about what the scope of our jurisdiction is in your appeal here, because you filed a notice of appeal, and in it you say that plaintiffs are hereby appealing to this court the final judgment entitled Memorandum and Order denying plaintiffs motion for reconsideration and motion for new trial that was entered on April 24, 2017. Now, that's different from the judgment that was entered after summary judgment. So let me just get to the question. Is this appeal limited? Is our jurisdiction limited to reviewing the court's decision on your motion for reconsideration under Rule 59E? That seems to be that all that you asked us to look at in your notice of appeal.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully submit to this court that it goes without saying that jurisdiction can be taken up at any time. Be taken up by this court here.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing. I'm asking about our jurisdiction.
Well, I think it's strictly jurisdictional.
It's what?
It's strictly jurisdictional. Rule 6.
What's the scope of our jurisdiction? I mean, what can we...
Well, I think the court can remand, find that Judge Magura erred when he determined that the motions were out of time because the a motion for extension of time was outside of the 14-day limit. Now, it was within the span of the 21-day limit because they just dovetailed each other. I mean, it was the motion for summary judgment and the Daubert motions filed on the same day. What we believe the court should do is say these are dispositive motions under the circumstances, and we got the Rembert versus Lilly case of the Tenth Circuit, that, you know, in these Daubert motions, California's come up with some stuff on motions to strike. In fact,
well, counsel,
the motions to strike are Daubert motions.
What bothers me is that this case goes back to 2015, and if you look at the docket sheet, you were late on almost every single motion that you were required to respond to.
I understand that.
And there was no other rule that you should seek an extension prior to the expiration of your time.
Well, I didn't. Not only
on this one, no, but on all these other entries, going back to April of 2015, joint motion to extend expert witness deadlines, didn't request an extension of plaintiff's already expired deadline, June 23rd, 2015, the court declined to extend the March 2nd deadline, and admonished you that you had to request the extension before the time expired. And it goes all the way up, all the way on right through the 23rd of March, which gets us up to the point where we're here now.
I would,
what is the problem with not responding to deadlines?
Well,
you say,
I have to assume some responsibility here, Your Honor, and I think that needs to go back for a hearing in front of Judge Madeira on those issues. But the plaintiff's case should not be stricken in this manner because, number one, there's really no showing of gamesmanship in this, any of the delays trying to gain advantage. There was no prejudice. Basically, it's a misunderstanding of the disclosure responsibilities. And I think that needs to be addressed. And I think I've stated that, Your Honor.
Thank you very much,
now,
Counsel. Now it's your time is up,
have,
and it's time for somebody else to talk.
I want to, I'm out?
You're out.
You're a minute over.
I wanted to give one more opportunity for the court.
Well, we might give you a minute at the end, but not now. Your time is up.
In 2013 in the District of Kansas,
let's see, what about up?
Of 2014 number of trials, 2%.
I'm told that you can't hear me. Your time is up.
Okay, I'm sorry,
Thank
Judge.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you may not have heard me either. I'm going to give you a minute at the end of rebuttal time to give us so you don't have to leave here thinking you.
I appreciate that.
All right. You're welcome.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sherry Rosell. I'm representing Ford Motor Company on this appeal. May it please the Court. The issues regarding this appeal are relatively simple. This, as Judge Matheson pointed out, is an appeal from a denial of a post-judgment motion to reconsider under Rules 59E and 60B. And the standard of review is abuse of discretion. So this court can only disturb the district court's decision if it has a definite and firm conviction that the lower court made a clear error of judgment or exceeded the bounds or permissible choice in the circumstances. The underlying case, just very briefly, is a products liability action, and the case comes to the court on this denial of the motion to reconsider four separate orders. One is the denial of the untimely request for additional time to respond to the Daubert motions, the granting of Ford's motion to exclude the testimony of plaintiff's expert, those are the Daubert motions, the granting of Ford's motion for summary judgment, and the entering of judgment in favor of Ford. Just very, very briefly, I'd like to talk about the McDermott's brief before we get to the merits of the appeal. You'll note that we have in our brief that the court should decline to consider the McDermott's arguments because their brief is inadequate to preserve any issues for appeal. The brief is unclear and confusing and really doesn't state how the district court abused its discretion, and it's very difficult to discern, if you can at all, whether the arguments relate to the 59E motion or the 60B motion. So it essentially puts this court in the position of becoming an advocate for the appellant to determine what, if any, viable arguments exist. And for these reasons, as the court did in the Nixon versus Denver case, we believe the court should refuse to consider the arguments presented.
Were you asked to, excuse me.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. Were you asked to grant an extension on the, and it was a couple of days late?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why did you turn it down? What kind of way is that to practice law?
The request came after the time period for the request had expired.
It was 3 days late, as I understood the brief.
Correct. And as it related to the motion for summary judgment, we indicated that we were not opposed to that. But as it related to the motion for extension of time to respond to the Daubert motions, they were out of time, so they really couldn't have even requested it from the court unless there was a showing of excusable neglect.
They could have requested it from opposing counsel, and it could have been given if we were a collegial group of people.
Well, I think the record kind of bears out that we've been very collegial in this case. There's been a long series of procedural defaults by the plaintiffs in this case, and for this particular one, they were outside the time period where they could even request any extension of time from the court unless they showed excusable neglect. And we advised the plaintiffs that's why we were unable to consent to the request for additional time.
Was that your client's direction? No extensions for any purpose?
I'm sorry?
I say, was that at your client's direction? No extensions for any purpose at this point? I just don't understand that. In New Mexico, we don't practice that way.
Well, with regard to this case and the very many missed deadlines and the procedural defaults by the plaintiffs, with regard to this particular request, because it came after the time period had expired to request an extension, for this particular one, we did deny it, Your Honor. I don't know that that constitutes being non-collegial, but we had been very cooperative in the case.
Okay.
So despite the briefing issues, what is clear is that this case comes to you on the denial of the post-judgment motion to reconsider under the two rules, 5090 and 60B, and we've got a clear abuse of discretion standard, which I believe even the appellants indicate is correct. So first, let's discuss the denial of 59E motion to alter or amend judgment. There are really three reasons when a motion can be granted to alter or amend the judgment. That's if there's an intervening change of the law, new evidence previously unavailable, or the need to correct clear error or manifest injustice. And in the 59E motion, it appears the McDermotts are only seeking relief under this last section to prevent clear error, manifest injustice. And this court has defined those terms. Clear error is arbitrary, capricious, manifestly unreasonable judgment, and manifest injustice is injustice that is indisputable. So the real question before this court is whether the district court abused its discretion in finding that there was no clear error or manifest injustice to be corrected as required by Rule 59E. And the answer to that question is clearly no for several reasons. First, the McDermott's argument that the Daubert motions were dispositive motions was raised for the first time in their motion to reconsider. And a motion to reconsider cannot be used to raise new arguments. So the court was well within its discretion to deny the motion on that basis alone, because this argument was new and it shouldn't have been considered. But not only was it new, it was fundamentally inconsistent with plaintiff's original explanation as to why their deadline was missed in the first place. So in the motion to reconsider, they're indicating that it's dispositive, but previously they indicated that the 14-day rule did apply, but they inappropriately added 3 days, mailing days, which they thought were applicable. So we have two different explanations as to why the deadline was dismissed. And secondly, even if the argument had been raised in the original motion for extension of time and not for the first time in the 59E motion, the court didn't abuse its discretion in finding that there was no clear error, manifest injustice, because based on the plain language of Rule 6.1D, which you, Judge Kelly, pointed out earlier, the Daubert motions were non-dispositive and the 14-day rule was properly applied. There's really no ambiguity in the rule. Your Honor, you did read subsection 2 of 6.1D. Subsection 1, I think, is clear as well. It defines non-dispositive motions, and it states responses to non-dispositive motions are motions other than motions to dismiss, motions for summary judgment, motions to remand, or motions for judgment on the pleadings, and they must be served and filed within 14 days. Then also, clearly in the rule, the parties have to request an extension before the specified time expires. And absent a showing of excusable neglect, the court won't grant those extensions. Likewise, there's no ambiguity in the effect of failing to file a timely responsive brief. Local Rule 7.4b says that if a responsive brief is not timely filed, the court will consider the motion as uncontested. And ordinarily, the court will grant the motion without further notice. Third, the McDermotts seem to make some policy arguments, and counsel, I think, referred to some of those this morning based on non-binding authority from other jurisdictions regarding the purposes of Daubert motions, motions in limine, and other pretrial motions, whether they are disfavored. But none of that really is instructive to the question before this court, whether the court abused its discretion in denying the motion to reconsider. We submit that there was no clear error of judgment by denying those motions.
Should a court take into consideration the seriousness of the case that is before it in deciding whether to forgive a late filing?
Well, the rule is very clear that the consideration to be made with regard to whether excusable neglect exists are really four factors, and the court did a very thorough job of reviewing each of those. The danger of prejudice to the opposing party is one. The court found actually that was relatively low because by that time Ford had already replied to the late filing. But the length of delay and potential impact on the proceedings, Judge Kelly, you pointed out some of those issues that the court had gone through in its decision, that while this was just a 3-day delay, it was the cumulative effect of the plaintiff's delays in the case that weighed against the finding of excusable neglect, because it prompted extensive briefings, motions to strike, and as early as April 2015, the plaintiff regularly missed deadlines and submitted filings out of time, and it wasted judicial resources. And the court further indicated that plaintiff's counsel's history didn't lead the court to believe that the plaintiff would change its ways. Then with regard to the reason for delay, which the court indicated was the most important factor, the judge referenced something that I've already referenced, which is the plaintiff first said that they used the old version of Rule 6, which included the 3-day rule, and they admitted that the 14-day rule did apply, and so the court was not persuaded that that was the actual reason. And even under the application of the old version of Rule 6 or the new, the deadline was the same. It was still the 14 days. And the court further noted that miscalculation.
When an evidentiary motion is filed in conjunction with a dispositive motion, a motion for summary judgment, should the rules be read to extend the same amount of time to these related motions as is extended to the substantive motion itself, given that you have to have a ruling on the evidentiary motion in order to properly respond to the dispositive motion?
No, Your Honor. The local rules clearly set forth different time periods for both.
No, I understand that.
Right.
That's not my question. My question is, when you have evidentiary motions that are filed in conjunction with dispositive motions, and the ruling on the dispositive motion is dependent on the ruling on the evidentiary motion, should the more comprehensive time limit govern?
I think no, Your Honor. The local rules
might be a way that Judge Murguia could have had a little compassion with this situation. I recognize it's very frustrating when people don't follow the rules. Very frustrating. But we have to remember that the consequence here is not to the lawyer so much as to the client. So the client is now out because of conduct on the part of the lawyer.
Right, Your Honor, and we cite some cases in our brief which indicate that the parties are bound by the actions of their attorneys.
That's like black letter law, right?
Right, agreed. But with regard to your question on the two different time periods, I think actually the way the rule sets it out makes more sense, because the Daubert motion, the response was 14 days. It's not self-executing. We have to file another motion to action the motion for summary judgment.
Just out of curiosity, what was the basis of the motion? Is this a substantively material Daubert motion? Because as I understand it, the expert had already issued a report. Correct?
Right, Your Honor.
And the report had been filed.
Correct.
And then there's a Daubert motion filed to attack the report. And what is the basis of the motion?
The basis for the motion, there were several. There were two experts at issue. One was attempting to provide some biomechanical expertise without the requisite qualifications. And also with regard to their design defect expert, we also submitted he didn't have the qualifications to provide any biomechanical testimonies.
So this isn't junk science, it's just qualification issues.
Well, no, it was there were issues relating to fit, lack of testing, and some testing that was done, which was unreliable. So there were issues of fit, reliability, and qualifications, all three.
Okay. I don't think there's any other questions. Did you have anything further?
No, Your Honor. I think we can rely on our briefing, particularly with regard to the abuse of discretion standard and the notice of appeal, Judge Matheson, that you pointed out, which really guides the jurisdiction of this court.
Right.
Thank you.
All right, counsel. We said we'd give you a minute, but please don't abuse it.
I agree with the analysis of the three-day rule. That does not give us any relief under the law. Justice O'Connor's in the seminal case back in the United States Supreme Court reviewed all that, and I think the only thing is being held hostage in a situation with a terrorist or something where there was a serious death or injury where you could not perform would be about the only way you could get under the definition of that as to the law as it stands today. I'm asking the court, I wanted to, in Kansas, District of Kansas, in 2013, 1.3% of cases went to trial. In 2014, the number rose to 2%. The 2015 percentage was down to 0.6%. There's a study, a draft study released by the University of Connecticut law professors Alexandria LaHav and Peter Stiegelman that indicates that in 2009, plaintiffs prevailed in only 35% of the civil cases in federal court that ended in any kind of judicial determination, including dismissal, summary judgment, default judgment, or judgment after a jury verdict. In 2009 rate, according to LaHav and Stiegelman...
I'm not sure you heard me the first time. I said I was granted as an act of gracious charity. I was going to extend you a minute and ask you not to abuse it. Now you're almost going to 2 minutes. And
I'm sorry.
Maybe you didn't hear me.
At any rate, I'd like the court to go with the Second and the Sixth Circuit and combine that.
Thank you very
much.
And get
us back down to court.
Counselor excused. The case is submitted.